welcome to another episode of the Ben's Podcast, Five Questions with the CEO, where we take a few minutes to talk with one of our members to learn more about their expertise and experience. Today, we've got a really unique member. We've got Ben's Southeast member, Ryan Millsap, who is the chairman and CEO of Black Hall Americana, which is a streaming service that will pursue programming that is high action, high intensity, and reflects the American spirit. Previously, Ryan was the CEO of the Georgia-based Black Hall Studios, which is an immense movie production facility just outside of Atlanta, with more than 850,000 square feet of production space. This has been the home to producing some well-known movies such as Venom, Jumanji, Jungle Cruise, Dr. Sleep, The Tomorrow War, and Godzilla, King of Monsters. All of the major production companies use these studio facilities, so including Disney, Sony, Warner Brothers, Universal, among others. So, Ryan, we're really glad to have you today. Thanks for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So let's get right into it here. I'm really interested if you can talk a little bit about how you got into the film industry and then how you kind of got located in the Atlanta area.
Yeah, those go together a little bit. My background's all commercial real estate, and that's where, you know, I made the majority of my initial capital. I started doing real estate projects as a principal when I was 26. I did land deals and then ended up doing a whole bunch of apartment deals, along with some kind of what I call sniper shot real estate deals that are, you know, unique assets that you can fix but aren't an entire business plan, where you might buy a warehouse and turn it into a retail environment, but you can't build a whole company around turning warehouses into retail. So after Lehman Brothers failed in 2008 and the world really fell apart, I partnered with some other families in Beverly Hills. We went out and bought 8,000 apartments in 2010, 11, 12, 13, a little bit into 14. And those were all 8,000 units were in the Southeast. And there's about 4,000 in Atlanta, and another 4,000 in the surrounding cities, Raleigh, Nashville, Chattanooga, Savannah. And that had me move to Atlanta in 2014. We had this huge portfolio. I was out here all the time. I was living in LA previously. I'd spent all my adult life in LA. And so I moved to Atlanta in 2014 to oversee that portfolio and just deal with all of the growth there. And that was the same year that Dan Cathy opened Pinewood Studios here in Atlanta, which I watched with interest because in 2012, we had done a deal in LA where we bought a warehouse in Hollywood that was down the street from Funny or Die, which is Will Ferrell's production company. And we had a plan to take that warehouse and turn it into creative office space. But after we bought the warehouse, Live Nation came to us and said, if you turn that warehouse into a soundstage, we'll lease it for 10 years. And I remember at the time asking the question, what's a soundstage? And the answer was basically, it's a soundproof box. And I said, why would you need a soundproof box? And they said, well, we have musical acts from all over the world that come to LA to prepare for their world tours, and they need a place where they can turn up the volume and not disturb the neighbors, and where they cannot be disturbed by whatever noises the neighbors are making. And I said, okay. And so we ended up building them this soundstage, and they leased it for 10 years. And that was my first experience with soundproof boxes being specialty real estate that the entertainment industry needed. And so when I moved to Atlanta and saw Dan Cathy build in Pinewood, I took a lot of interest in what he was doing. And I thought, why did he build that soundstage complex so far away from the city? And I later then found out Dan Cathy was from this area south of Atlanta called Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that, you know, what he had built was an interesting hobby for a guy who had already been wildly successful. Dan is the primary family patriarch of Chick-fil-A. You know, his father, Truett Cathy, had started Chick-fil-A. Dan took it over, and now he's passed it on to leadership with his son, Andrew. Dan's been a really good friend to me over the years in this movie studio business. He's been a wonderfully kind and generous competitor, but a friend before everything else. But he built Pinewood Studios in Fayetteville really as like something he was really interested in. And it didn't necessarily have a real estate strategy to it other than he wanted to build a studio for Georgia, and he wanted it to be near where he was from and where he lived. And so when I saw that, I thought to myself, you know, in real estate, there's a basic principle, which is if you have a use that works in a bad location, you know, not that Fayetteville is bad, it's just not the best, then if you take that use and put it in a better location, it works even better. You know, it's a pretty simple principle. Yeah. And so because Dan had proven that there was market demand for a movie studio, and he'd proven that there was market demand in an inferior location, then it opened for me the possibility of saying, well, I could do that as a real estate guy in a better location. And that's what I ended up doing. So in 2016, I built something called Black Hole Studios inside the perimeter of Atlanta. I ran that for about 5.5 years, and then I sold it to private equity. And that went really well. And in the midst of doing that, then I observed a bunch of opportunity inside of Hollywood to create a streaming platform and content that was different than what was being produced in Hollywood. And that's what we're in the midst of doing right now with Black Hole Americana. And I can tell you about that if you like, but you might have some other questions before I
tell that story. We're definitely going to get to that. So thanks. That's fascinating to listen to the story of how you got to where you are on this. I wonder if maybe I can invite you to talk a little bit about, and again, on this idea of movie sets here, what's a particularly favorite movie site or a movie set that for you? And then can you share a story or two about some of the unique problem solving that goes into running a business like this, doing movie sets and helping the film industry?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of my favorite sets that was built at Black Hole was when Dwayne Johnson and Disney were making the movie Jungle Cruise. They came in and they actually built a 750,000 gallon water tank in one of our parking lots. They actually dug down about 12 feet and created this huge swimming pool, effectively, that became the primary place for filming all of the scenes. If you watch that movie, all of the scenes where they are in the boat. Wow. And it was incredible to watch the way that they could transform a space that literally is a parking lot, wrap it in blue screen, drop a fake boat that they, you know, build as a prop into this pretend river/ocean, depending on what they needed it to look like, and then do all that filming, a long ways from the Amazon. And so that was a super cool piece of engineering that we watched them do. And then they also built a massive treehouse that inside of one of our sound stages. Sound stages have clear height of about 40 feet to the grid. And they built this treehouse that was all the way up to the grid, and it filled about a 20,000 square foot volume inside of a 40,000 square foot stage. And it was, you know, just, it's kind of like Swiss Family Robinson. You could walk through this crazy treehouse. And when they were filming, it was then filled with, Aboriginal type warriors, you know, Amazonian warriors with, you know, painted faces and spears and the whole nine yards. So I thought that was, you know, for sure one of the highlights. Venom filmed at Black Hole, and it had some really incredible scenes, including they built an entire prison inside of one of our, an entire prison. They built a wing of a prison inside of one of our sound stages where Woody Harrelson showed up for the end of Venom, the first one. And then when the Tomorrow War was at Black Hole with Chris Pratt, they built a really cool indoor water tank that was attached to the fake top of a skyscraper. So they had this fake condo tower that was just the top two floors, and then a pool on the deck of the what would have been the roof of this fake condo tower. And then when they were filming, they had actually people falling out of the sky into this deep water tank. And so it was kind of like Cirque du Soleil when they were doing that filming. It was, you know, I thought that was pretty amazing. Wow. Dr. Sleep was filmed at Black Hall, and I have really fond memories of all of the work they did. They built the entire Shining Hotel inside of one of the sound stages, complete with, you know, reflections on all of the blue corridors of that hotel, and all, and even the door that Jack Nicholson had wow. used an axe on, right? They rebuilt all of that. And so it was pretty wild to walk through all of that scene when they were filming Dr. Sleep. I mean, I could go on, but those are some of my favorite highlights on the set side.
That's great. That's so interesting to hear about that whole experience here. So you know, now you're kind of into the streaming services, and I wonder if you can maybe talk a little bit more about that and the risks associated with moving into this area. There certainly seems to be a lot of focus on moving into streaming services now.
Yeah, you know, Netflix obviously really kicked this off, and they showed about 8 years ago that if you built a platform and made your own content, that you could completely disintermediate Hollywood distribution, which basically just means you could make your own content and sell it directly to consumers in exchange for a subscription fee. And they were the first ones to do this on any scale. And they really did it as a last-ditch effort to avoid failure, because at the time they were distributing other people's content, and the other people were starting to see that there was an opportunity to distribute their own content, and Netflix was going to lose a lot of the content from other people. And so they, in kind of a Hail Mary, decided to make their own content, and they made two shows. They made House of Cards with Kevin Spacey, and they made Orange is the New Black, which was a show about a suburban woman who gets sent to prison, and as a comedy. And those two shows really launched all of Netflix, and as we know Netflix today, because prior to that time, they only distributed other people's content. And after that, they were distributing stuff that they dreamed up, owned the intellectual property to, and paid to create. That changed the landscape dramatically, because they showed that you could make content in Hollywood and then not ask permission from any of the other production companies to distribute it, and you could have success. And that opened the door to then people like me and Black Hole Americana to come in later and capitalize on that same phenomenon. So right now, the opportunity that we see is that Hollywood in general has, you know, say, ironically, some lack of creativity. It's a 100-year-old industry. All the original founding entrepreneurs are dead, and they've been dead for many decades. And so all of these production companies are run by people that have inherited the keys to those kingdoms, whether it's the Disney kingdom or the Paramount kingdom or the Sony kingdom or the Warner Brothers kingdom. The people that run those kingdoms have inherited those keys from many generations of other managers. And you have to go back a long way before you get back to one of the founders who created those companies. And so oftentimes they lack a lot of ingenuity. They lack the courage of an entrepreneur that leads to risk-taking and innovation. And that was fine for a long time, because they held the ultimate power, which was they held a monopoly on distribution. But when Netflix showed that they didn't have a monopoly anymore on distribution, and the internet opened up the opportunity to distribute on your own, then, you know, for the first time in the history of entertainment, there was opportunity for people to come from the outside and not have to ask permission. Yeah, so absolutely. That's where we sit today. You know, in 2018, I was walking my lot with Netflix, and they told me that they needed a lot more sound stages. I said, why? They said, well, we need to make $8 billion of content next year, which was a huge number. Last year, they actually made $17 billion, but this was years ago. And I thought to myself, $8 billion, that's a lot. I said, how much did you make last year? And they said, well, we made $4 billion in content. And I thought to myself, you made $4 billion in content? I can't find anything to watch on Netflix.
Yeah.
And what are you doing with all that money? And I asked the same question today, like, what did you do with that $17 billion? And so it got me thinking, you know, between the realization that the industry was 100 years old, and the entrepreneurs were dead, and that Netflix was making all this content, yet I was having a hard time finding anything quality. It was like kind of my style of stuff to watch. And then, you know, one of my good buddies from college, who, when we got out of college, he went on and became one of the most, you know, famous Navy SEALs of our generation. He was a SEAL for 14 years. 9 of those years, he was on SEAL Team 6. He got in some military trouble with the military for writing a couple books when he left the SEALs under the pen name Mark Owen. And and that is his public persona, Mark Owen. But when he got out of the SEALs, he went out to LA and he got a meeting with Les Moonves, who was running CBS at the time. And he pitched Les on the idea of the show SEAL Team on CBS. And Les greenlit that show. He was excited about it. And so he said, we're going to make that show. And so my buddy then started to try to get that show off the ground. And he ran into a lot of trouble. Like, he found a lot of the other executives at CBS didn't care about the show, didn't want to see CBS making military shows, and in general tried to squash it. And he really leaned on Les, and Les is the one who forced that and said, no, we're making that show, we're making that show. And it finally got made. So of course, like, I think it's in its fifth season. It's been wildly successful. Yeah. He's done some really innovative things, like all of the B-roll in that show is actual ex-SEALs and Delta operators. That's why the tactical movement is so authentic. But he's had a huge amount of success. But he was telling me this story about how when he goes to make that show in LA, he gets off the plane and he pulls his baseball cap down real low and he drives to the CBS studios in the Valley. And they go about making their show as quietly as they can, because culturally and sociologically in California, nobody really wanted to see their tanks or their C-17s or their definitely didn't want to see their guns, and they didn't want to see their uniforms. And in general, the society at large and the particular production society at that facility was not thrilled about the fact that they were making a show about the military. They didn't find that to be patriotic. They didn't find that to be interesting. And I said to him, I said, when he told me this story, I thought to myself, you know, if you were making that show in Georgia, you'd be a hero. People would be thrilled about SEAL Team being made. Everybody who was on that show would be locally known and local celebrity. The producers and the directors would be known, and people would be very proud of the fact that we were making a show about our elite operators. But, you know, that show confounds a lot of CBS executives, because nobody in LA really watches it, and nobody in New York really watches it. But people across the middle of the United States watch the heck out of that show, and they love it. And so you combine all of these elements, and what we have endeavored to create with Black Hole Americana and are in the middle of creating is a content service that focuses on action adventure and does everything from Black Hawk Down and SEAL Team, like a real military vertical, which my buddy Mark will oversee. And then all the way over to like John Wick, which is just tactical gun movement, which a lot of us really enjoy. And I think there's a hugely underserved market for this, what's called gung fu. It's really like kung fu, but it's just with guns. And it's just, you know, for people that like guns and like action, it's really delightful, because that's basically all it is. And then, you know, all the stuff in between, which is, you know, the stories about courage and persistence and fortitude, that are stories like Rocky and stories like Rambo and Commando and, you know, all of the old 007 movies from the 60s and 70s that are high action and really driven by more lizard brain entertainment, where you get engaged without necessarily engaging your frontal cortex. So, you know, we're really focused on banging out as much of this action adventure content as we can. And we think it's a hugely underserved market that, I know for one have a really hard time finding enough of that kind of content on the streaming platform. So that's what we're endeavoring to do.
That's really interesting. I really appreciate you talking about the idea behind Black Hall Americana and what you're trying to do there. One of the things we're seeing these days, Ryan, is the impact on supply and demand and other things. A lot of this is a result of the pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about how the pandemic has affected the film world? And things that you've had to do to kind of change your business model to adapt?
Yeah, I mean, obviously during the early stages of the pandemic, the whole world of film and television was shut down for about 6 months. It just ground to a halt. It took that much time, not only for us all to come out of the sequestering of the first 90 days of the pandemic, but then after that, the industry had to try to visit protocols that would make it possible to make film and television in the midst of a pandemic. And they did that. The unions and the workers unions and the producers unions and the directors unions all worked together to come up with protocols that everybody could buy into. And by about September of 2020, everything started back up, but with, I would guess, a 20% cost premium built in, which was all of the COVID protocols that existed. Wow. And so that was one of the major impacts to the industry, just the additional cost of filming in the midst of a pandemic. Certainly, that's on the negative side, just working through all of those logistics. But on the positive side, you had all these people staying home for months at a time and binge watching everything they could get their hands on. And so it created a huge spike in demand for online content and streamed content, which has not abated. That demand has carried over from the COVID lockdowns, and more people are engaged with streaming than ever before. And so it had an initial hugely negative impact on the ability to fill a pipeline with content, but then post agreeing to protocols around COVID, it's had a huge positive impact on demand for content. Now, you're asking questions about supply chain and logistics. Right now, our biggest supply chain issue really is around qualified bodies, finding enough qualified, trained crew to make the amount of content that is in demand right now in the world. And it's just hard to keep up with because most of these crew members are trained on the job and it's kind of like apprenticeships. And those apprenticeships, you need mini productions to grow in your skill. So you might serve under, if you're somebody who works in lighting, then you might serve under somebody who is a more senior lighting expert. And after a few shows, then you can kind of move up the ladder. But none of that ladder and that pipeline is moving fast enough to keep up with the desire of customers to consume content.
That's really interesting. Wow. I was not expecting that you would talk about although I guess I should have been on the workforce aspect of this, but that's really interesting. Ryan, we're coming to the end here. So let me ask you the question I ask all of our members on this is what brought you to Ben's?
Well, one of my good buddies named Spike Wallen, that I know from, we got to know each other shooting shotguns and Spike and I became, better friends. He just said to me one day, he goes, I'm part of this organization that I think you would really fit in with, that you'd benefit from, that you'd enjoy, that you could contribute to. And he started telling me about Ben's, and it was wonderful for me to hear about because I don't know a lot of organizations where business guys and kind of military thinkers come together to think about all the ways that they can try to protect our country, make our country better, put us all in a position to, live our lives to the fullest and the maximum amount of freedom and safety. And so when he explained to me and the teams inside of Ben's explained to me what the organization was about. I thought it was a really good fit. So I joined, I'm not sure how many years ago, but it's been a really good fit for me. I've loved the guys I've gotten to know. It's a spirit of patriotism that feels like what should be mainstream, but oftentimes isn't. And so I've been really grateful for the time I've spent at Benz.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much for that. I think one of the things that really makes our organization unique is that we do bring people, business people with very varied backgrounds here, all really focused on securing the nation here. So really appreciate your comments there, Ryan. We've really enjoyed having you on today. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Great. Thanks. And for our listeners, thanks for listening today. We've been talking with Ryan Millsap, the chairman and CEO of Black Hall Americana, Ben's Southeast member. We look forward to catching you the next time we do one of these podcasts. So thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.